Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. And this week, the final program in our major four-part series, The Long Shadow, exploring the legacies of World War I. In his great novel War and Peace, Leo Tolstoy gives a cameo role to a Prussian officer serving with the Russian army, a man named Karl von Clausewitz. Like many of Tolstoy's characters, von Clausewitz was a real person, probably the best-known philosopher of modern war. In War and Peace, Tolstoy uses Clausewitz to make a point about the moral emptiness of reducing war to a series of rational actions. For Tolstoy, war was fundamentally chaotic and uncontrollable, but for Clausewitz, war was policy by other means. War and Peace is presented by Gary Bryson.
Rostov stood at the corner for a long time, watching the feast from a distance. In his mind, a painful process was going on which he could not bring to a conclusion. Terrible doubts rose in his soul. Now he remembered Denisov with his changed expression, his submission, and the whole hospital, with arms and legs torn off and its dirt and disease. So vividly did he recall that hospital stench of dead flesh that he looked round to see where the smell came from. Next, he thought of that self-satisfied Bonaparte, with his small white hand, who was now an emperor liked and respected by Alexander. Then why those severed arms and legs and those dead men? Then again he thought of Lazarev rewarded and Denisov punished and unpardoned. He caught himself harboring such strange thoughts that he was frightened.
When Tolstoy first went to war himself, when he was a young man in 1852, when he went off to the Caucasus for the sake of adventure, and also to escape his own bad urges for gambling and women and so on, what he was really concerned about is whether he was brave enough to be a soldier.
Clausewitz and Tolstoy both looked at the issue of control, and the control that we can have over our actions, including in war, and the role that chance plays in affecting our control. And I think that Clausewitz's concern with the issue of control is a political one, and Tolstoy's concern is a moral one.
As we approach, the rumble of guns grows louder and alternates with the whir of cannonballs. Shots begin to strike close around us. Cannonballs and bursting shells are frequent, and life begins to seem more serious than the young man had imagined. Suddenly, someone you know is wounded. Then a shell falls among the staff. You notice that some of the officers act a little oddly. You yourself are not as steady and collected as you were.
Karl von Clausewitz was a soldier all his life. He was also that rare thing in a military man of his era, a scholar and a philosopher, who more than anyone else defined the nature of modern warfare.
He was the son of a soldier who had himself served in the Seven Years' War.
Professor Sir Hugh Strawn is Shishel Professor of the History of War at All Souls College, the University of Oxford.
And he joins the army himself at the age of 12, which, of course, is an extraordinarily impressionable age to become a soldier, and served in the War of the First Coalition between 1792 and 1795. So by the end of the war, he's 15. He's born in 1780. And his adolescence is therefore really passed in uniform. His rite of passage to adulthood is military service. And what is extraordinary for somebody given that background is that he's also somebody who is an autodidact, who wants to go off and learn. So when he's not soldiering, he doesn't just sit in the mess and drink and play cards. He takes himself off to the library. And this being the 1790s, that means an engagement with political philosophy, with the ideas of the Enlightenment, with ideas about the relationship between the state and the individual. A very strong theoretical education.
It is, of course, well known that the only source of war is politics, the intercourse of governments and peoples. We maintain that war is simply a continuation of political intercourse with the addition of other means. If war is part of policy, policy will determine its character. As policy becomes more ambitious and vigorous, so will war, and this may reach the point where war attains its absolute form. Policy is the guiding intelligence, and war only the instrument, not vice versa.
At the beginning of the 19th century, between 1795 and 1806, Prussia, the state to which Clausewitz belongs, is at peace. It's not continuous warfare as it is for Britain and France, for example. And in that time, having spent time with his regiment, he then goes to the War Academy in Berlin, where he falls under the influence of a great Prussian military reformer, Scharnhorst, who becomes a quasi-father figure and who says to him, in order to understand war, you also need to understand the reality of war. You need to study military history as well as to think about the theory of war. You can't understand war just by being abstract. And that is a very powerful influence. It means military history is always a big part of Clausewitz's thinking. And it also means that he then uses his own experiences, which from 1806, when Prussia fights again against the French, until the Waterloo campaign of 1815, he has a continuous round of really important experiences on the battlefield, taking part in major campaigns and coming to grips with, you know, the person he described as the god of war, that is to say, Napoleon.
War in the time of Napoleon may appear to be light years away from the carnage of World War I. But it was Napoleon who first mobilised mass conscript armies, who understood the importance of artillery, and who made war an instrument of the state.
Soldiers up until then had understood war in terms very largely of what happened on the battlefield, in terms of tactics. And Clausewitz is aware that what you do with the tactical outcome, what you do with the battle, how you exploit the battle, how you put it to good account is the crucial thing, and what Napoleon above all had done. And so he and his near contemporary, Jomini, a Swiss, develop really modern thinking about strategy, but they develop it in the very direct context of the Napoleonic Wars.
Clausewitz lived through a tremendous change in warfare that occurred in the 1790s and 1800s.
David E. Kaiser is an historian and a former professor in the Strategy and Policy Department of the United States Naval War College.
In the 18th century, armies were more like armies today, actually. They were relatively small, they were professional, and they had fought a long series of limited wars. And all that was transformed by the French Revolution and Napoleon as he came to mobilize men and resources on an unprecedented scale. They won decisive victories, they overturned whole nations, Napoleon redrew the map of Europe. And eventually, the other nations of Europe, including Clausewitz's own country, Prussia, had to follow suit to win.
For Prussia, for the state of which Clausewitz is a member, this is a war of national survival. He hates the French. He hates Napoleon while admiring him. He cannot see how a small state like Prussia can possibly beat the French and is consequently amazed when they do end up on the winning side in 1815. But his ideas of war are written against this background of very strong nationalism, which we tend to lose sight of when we think theoretically. We remove ourselves from the passion which Clausewitz felt when he fought the French.
Clausewitz's most famous book on war was published posthumously in 1832. Part handbook, part philosophical treatise, it demonstrates a close engagement with the Enlightenment ideas of his time.
He was living in a great age of rationalism. This was one of the great intellectual ages of Western civilization. Clausewitz was writing actually at roughly the same time that Tocqueville was writing Democracy in America, for instance. And On War, although it's a difficult book, is one of the classics of Western literature and analysis. And he believed that war could and should be subject to reason. And in his time, for the most part, it had been. And the Napoleonic Wars, although they were very large in scale, I mean, the largest wars in scale until the First World War, 100 years later, The campaigns tended to be relatively short, and they tended to end with decisive victories and peace treaties. So it all seemed to make sense. But you can see in the book that he understands how difficult it is, this is one of his themes really, to subordinate passion to reason.
Clausewitz understood that while war could be subordinated to human reason, it was also subject to the vagaries of chance and fate, and was intensely emotional. In this sense, his work owes something to the Romantic movement, which sought to restore passion as a principal force in nature. Hugh Smith is Associate Professor of Politics at the Australian Defence Force Academy.
The Enlightenment urge was to analyse, to develop certainties, to identify irregularities, to analyse war in the same way that people were analysing the movement of planets or the weather or whatever. And some people hoped to develop principles of war which would actually guide commanders along the road to winning battles and winning wars, some concrete positive principles. On the other hand, there were the romantics in military thinking who thought war is so chaotic, so subject to chance, the only way through it is to look to the great hero, the great commander who, by sheer genius, sheer persistence, force of will, can drive his forces and win battles and win wars. Those were the two sort of extremes. And Clausewitz, I think, has elements of both. He sees some regularities in war, but not so deep and so strong that they can actually closely guide you in how to win a war. And equally sees the importance of personality in war. But again, that's within his broader framework. Personality, genius is important, but it is not all decisive.
What do we mean by the defeat of the enemy? Simply, the destruction of his forces, whether by death, injury, or any other means, either completely or enough to make him stop fighting. The complete or partial destruction of the enemy must be regarded as the sole object of all engagements. Direct annihilation of the enemy's forces must always be the dominant consideration.
Clausewitz believed you needed theory to think about war, to understand war, to realise the distinctions, the elements of war, the concepts you needed to use in war. And he put forward a number of important concepts like centre of gravity or the culminating point of the campaign or friction, concepts we still use today in thinking about military strategy. So you needed these theoretical concepts when you approach war, but they would not guide you in detail in the practice of war. War was not a science, it was more of an art where you needed judgment, you needed instinct, you needed genius, you needed persistence.
In explaining his theory of war, Clausewitz compares real war with what he calls pure or absolute war. It's a common philosophical technique.
What he is doing, he's using a method from contemporary German philosophy called the ideal type. And it's really very elegant because he starts out by saying, all right, it's a contest to make the enemy do your will. And let's push this to a logical extreme. What would this look like? Well, in a logical extreme, what it would look like is that you would deploy all your forces, send them into battle, all out battle, and you would literally fight until only one side was left standing. And that is what he calls absolute war. And some people have been seduced by that into thinking about how could we do this in practice. But that is a very clear misreading of Clausewitz, because if you look at the discussion, he immediately says this isn't the way it is in real life.
Absolute war is a concept where war runs totally smoothly. There's no chance. There's total passion, total reason. It's an abstract concept from which real war always departs.
real war is much more complicated. And what he says again and again in the book is that when you're confronted with a real war, what are the factors in this case which are going to differentiate it from an absolute war? And that will be your guide to strategy.
The centerpiece of Clausewitz's theory of war is what he calls the wonderful trinity.
War is, therefore, not only chameleon-like in character, because it changes its color in some degree in each particular case, but it is also, as a whole, in relation to the predominant tendencies which are in it, a wonderful trinity, composed of the original violence of its elements, hatred and animosity, which may be looked upon as blind instinct, of the play of probabilities and chance, which make it a free activity of the soul, and of the subordinate nature of a political instrument, by which it belongs purely to the reason.
This is where one of his key ideas, perhaps the key idea, comes in, that all wars are a trinity, a mixture of three things, of passion, which drives people to fight, reason, which sees them try to control warfare towards a given end, and chance, the great uncertainty, chaos, confusion that prevails in every war, at every level, at least in some measure. And every war is a mixture of those three things.
The order he gives is first primordial violence, hatred, and enmity, the emotional aspect, which he says is mainly associated with the people. Second, the play of chance and probability, by which he means what's happening on the battlefield, and that is the province of the army. And thirdly, the political objective, which is the responsibility of the government, and which should be the controlling factor in the war.
For Clausewitz, while war was certainly subject to the vagaries of chance, it was also an instrument of the state. War, in his famous aphorism, was policy by other means. Far from being a throwaway line, this idea begs the question of who should ultimately control the course and conduct of war, the generals or the state? Hugh Strong.
He means it as a theory. He's trying to find a unifying way of understanding war. And the unifying way is to say it is a political instrument. We have to understand it within the context of policy. But then, of course, he comes up against a problem, which is the problem that there is often clashes, or there can often be clashes, between what seems sensible militarily and what the politician might want to do, or between what is militarily possible and what policy might aspire. And here, he's much more ambiguous because he will say, for example, and quite reasonably, there is no point policy demanding of war something it can't deliver. So there has to be a two-way relationship between these two, their intention.
Clausewitz's book on war became required reading for aspiring generals in the decades leading to World War I. It was often misunderstood by those unable to grasp its subtleties.
Clausewitz's influence before 1914 is much debated. He absolutely is up there before 1914 as the military theorist to read. He is seen as the one produced by Germany, and Germany, after the wars of German unification in 1866 and 1871, is seen as the military power to emulate. The 1905 edition of Clausewitz, published in Germany, has a foreword by Schlieffen himself, so it has the imprimatur of the chief of the general staff. And when further editions come out during the course of the First World War itself, 1915 particularly, there are recommendations from serving generals stuck in the front of the German edition. So the argument is that it has a big influence. Less influence in France and Britain, but certainly not negligible there either. The real issue is, what do they draw from this? And what they draw from this is what they want to read, because that's the problem with Clausewitz. Precisely because he proceeds by debate, there is everything there, and you can take out of it what you will. The desire before 1914 is to take out, first of all, the idea that campaigns can be short and end with a decisive victory, And secondly, to take up the great stress on morale, the big worry for armies in 1914 is they know the battlefield has changed tremendously, that the advent of machine guns, quick-firing artillery, breech-loading rifles, all this is going to make it a very dangerous place to be.
The idea of the decisive victory, where winning a battle could force your enemy to sue for peace, was more suited to the Napoleonic era than to the realities of industrial warfare. But it found expression in the Schlieffen Plan, Germany's blueprint in 1914 for a quick war against France, over by Christmas.
What Clausewitz means by decisive victory is a victory that allows you to make peace. And he says that the best way to do that is to destroy the enemy army or to occupy his capital or to deliver a great blow to his ally if the ally is more powerful than he is. And actually, all of those things have been done by Napoleon. And in fact, the Schlieffen Plan, the German campaign plan against France, and as it turned out, Britain, certainly looks as if it could have been based on those parts of Clausewitz because they wanted to outflank and surround the French army, and they wanted to take Paris. And their assumption was that that would force the French to make peace. Now, in fact, it looked like it had almost succeeded, but I think that was probably a bit illusory. What it turned out was the Germans were able to move all the way through Belgium and deep into France. But the logistical problems of moving so many men with all the supplies needed in modern war were so immense that they really weren't in any shape to fight the Battle of the Marne, as I understand it, and they had to retreat, and then things stabilized. Now, after that, yes, both sides are spinning all kinds of fantasies about how they can get a decisive result. The tragedy of the war is that for different reasons, both sides are convinced that they're winning. The Germans are convinced that they're winning because they are winning in the east, where they advance pretty steadily, and they've occupied Belgium and a big chunk of northern France, so it looks like things are going well. The Allies, on the other hand, feel they're economically stronger. They keep getting new allies. They feel time is on their side, and eventually they will prevail. And therefore, no one shows enough interest in a negotiated peace.
There are strategic thinkers who say this is how to do it. Win a war by winning a decisive victory. Clausewitz is too good a thinker to do that. So he is always producing a counter to an argument. The whole book proceeds by debate. And the importance of the book is that it's not so much how to wage a war, but how to understand war. And so when, he says, battle is the center of war, using the outcome of the battle to achieve a decisive victory, that is crucially important. What he also says, of course, is that there can be indecisive battles. We know that. You know, it's not always going to turn out that way. And wars can end indecisively. Through negotiation, a peace settlement can be decided because two sides have exhausted themselves and aren't going to carry on fighting. So he sees many options. But of course he has to put decisive battle at the heart because for every soldier, not only who had served in the Napoleonic Wars, but all those who would themselves serve right up until 1914, that is the Napoleonic model. The ideal becomes that of a short campaign which culminates in a decisive victory.
Germany and Britain, too, expected the war to be over by Christmas 1914 in different ways, but they expected a quick result. I think it's unfair to blame Clausewitz for this. I think you have to blame those who wanted to believe this element of Clausewitz, who wanted to believe war was something you went in, boots and all, you went in for a quick, total decisive victory. That probably is the main factor leading people to misunderstand what was happening in 1914, that they wanted a quick victory and they believed that illusion. I think if they'd read Clausewitz much more carefully, they would have seen how complex, how risky, how uncertain an adventure war is.
Misunderstood by military leaders who reduced his philosophy to aphorisms and who sought quick solutions and decisive victories with no clear political end, Clausewitz nevertheless has the last word. World War I, says David Kaiser, came to an end much as the philosopher himself might have predicted.
He talked about how the government has to arouse passion and hatred among the people, and all the governments most certainly did that. That was to achieve a great political objective, the second leg of the Trinity, namely the defeat of the enemy. But that had to be done on the battlefield, and they couldn't make it happen on the battlefield. And what eventually happened, first in Russia in 1917, also in Italy, in the Italian army in late 1917, and then in late 1918 in Austria-Hungary, in Turkey, and in Germany, was that the passion within the army and within the people turned against the government. And you had revolutions in March, the overthrow of the Tsar, in November, the Bolshevik Revolution. The Italian army basically collapsed and largely mutinied after Caporetto. There were mutinies in various armies. And then there are revolutions in Austria-Hungary and Turkey and Germany that take the Central Powers out of the war from September through November of 1918 because the people won't take it anymore and they turn against their governments. This was not altogether a surprise, and in fact, among all the governments in their internal deliberations, they are discussing this by 1916. The issue is who's going to collapse first, and let's hope it isn't going to be us. But they knew how much strain they were putting their people under, and it did indeed turn out to be too much, with just tremendous consequences, again, for at least the rest of the 20th century.
Since war is not an act of senseless passion, but is controlled by its political object, the value of this object must determine the sacrifices to be made for it in magnitude and also in duration. Once the expenditure of effort exceeds the value of the political object, the object must be renounced and peace must follow.
And you're listening to Hindsight on RN, and today, Clausewitz and Tolstoy, one a philosopher of war, the other a pacifist. How do these great thinkers enrich our understanding of both war and peace?
In the old days, he had been unable to see the great, the unfathomable, and the infinite in anything. He had only felt that it must be somewhere and had been seeking it. In everything near and comprehensible, he had seen only what was limited, petty, everyday, and meaningless. He had armed himself with a telescope of intellect and gazed far away into the distance where that petty, everyday world, hidden in the mists of distance, had seemed to him great and infinite, simply because it was not clearly seen. Such had been European life, politics, Freemasonry, philosophy, and philanthropy in his eyes. But even then, in moments which he had looked on as times of weakness, his thought had penetrated even to these remote objects, and then he had seen in them the same pettiness, the same ordinariness, and meaninglessness. Now he had learned to see the great, the eternal, and the infinite in everything. And naturally, therefore, in order to see, to revel in its contemplation, he flung aside the telescope through which he had hitherto been gazing over men's heads and looked joyfully at the ever-changing, ever-grand, unfathomable, and infinite life around him. And the closer he looked at it, the calmer and happier he was. The terrible question that had shattered all his intellectual edifices in the old days, the question, what for, had no existence for him now. To that question, what for, he had now always ready in his soul a simple answer. Because there is a God. That God without whom not one hair of a man's head falls.
Like Clausewitz, Leo Tolstoy was also a soldier who experienced war at first hand. most tellingly perhaps in the desperate siege of Sevastopol during the Crimean War. Tolstoy's response, however, was to generate deep insights into war in its human context. Insights that drove his fiction and eventually led him towards pacifism. For Tolstoy, war is fundamentally chaotic and uncontrollable. And Clausewitz's attempt to subject it to the control of human reason is morally empty. To illustrate this, Tolstoy has Clausewitz make a cameo appearance in War and Peace. Here's Donna Tussing-Orwin, Professor of Russian Literature at the University of Toronto.
Clausewitz is talking with another German officer, and Prince Andrei overhears them. And the officer is saying, you know, he's talking about war in very technical terms, in those mathematical terms, as if an army was a big machine that technocrats could work with. I've wondered whether Tolstoy himself actually read Clausewitz, because in many ways I think Tolstoy's and Clausewitz's ideas of what war is are the same. Maximum chaos, maximum breakdown of human communication. In that sense, a deepening experience, because it opens us to ourselves in the chaotic world in which we actually live, and especially it opens us to our helplessness vis-a-vis mortality. Clausewitz has that same existential view of war with the chance and the chaos and so on, and you can oppose Clausewitz in this respect to other theorists of the time. This was his great innovation, as it were. But where I think Tolstoy would have found Clausewitz to be alien and immoral would be the idea that war is a continuation of politics by other means, that you should use war to advance political gains. Tolstoy would not agree with that.
There are many, many things that make it difficult to keep control of war, in Clausewitz's view, and the many small phenomena that just stop us being able to use war to gain the ends that we want. And I think Tolstoy's view of war, and indeed the whole of life, is very similar.
Colin McGeough is Senior Lecturer in Political Science and Public Policy at the University of Waikato.
Tolstoy, in his literature, was very much a realist. He was able to describe in immense detail all of the tiny phenomena that make up reality. And when he comes to look at war, again, Tolstoy sees the obstructive intransigence of reality, all of those very small things that just stop us being able to achieve outcomes. So they do take the same view of the reality of war. They both see that it is very complex. It is made up of very many factors, some small, and that because of that complex reality, it is very difficult to achieve outcomes in war.
He thought that there was only one kind of war that had any justification, which was a defensive war. But what you really learn if you go to war is that war is blood, suffering, and death. So that was his definition of war. And then, of course, then the question becomes, why would anybody go to war?
To understand Tolstoy's pacifism, we have to go back firstly to his early years. Born into an aristocratic family, the young Tolstoy was much given to gambling and loose living. Rosamund Bartlett is an author and translator and a specialist in Russian literature.
He was born into the landed aristocracy. He was born Count Lev Nikolaevich Tolstoy, came from a very illustrious family. But he lost both his parents by the time he was seven. So he was brought up by a succession of aunts and substitute aunts in various places. And his family was also quite eccentric. So there were four boys and a girl, and they were all quite strange, the Tolstoy brothers. And they grew up in a rather sort of unruly way. And he was incredibly profligate in his lifestyle as a young man, and would go off to Moscow or go off to Petersburg, would carouse with gypsies and spend a lot of money on cards and have to sell one of his estates to meet his debts. And this went on until his early 20s. And then on a complete whim, he decided to follow his elder brother Nikolai down to the Caucasus. Russia annexed Georgia in 1801, and there were lots of hill tribes who resisted the Russian incursion, and there was a long war fought along the Russian frontier, aided by the Cossacks. And so Tolstoy, because he didn't have anything much better to do, he just decided to go along, and then ended up, of course, getting very interested and decided to volunteer, and then he decided to enlist and get a commission as a young officer. This is really where he began to sort of discover some purpose and also decided to become a writer too. So both those things are going on in his early 20s. And this is the early 1850s where we're speaking about.
Was he a good soldier?
He was a pretty good soldier, I think. He was unlucky. And one of the things which you see coming out in his later life, in a work like Confession, for example, is this search when he was a young man for military glory. And you see that also in the character of Andrei in War and Peace. So he wanted to be a good soldier and he wanted to win medals. And he very narrowly missed getting the sort of main medal for his military service for various reasons. Once, because he was playing chess and hadn't come on parade. He was a little bit unruly even as a soldier. But he did fight with distinction in the Crimean War. He was involved in the defence of Sebastopol as an artillery officer and saw real war at close hand there in a way that he hadn't really seen it in the skirmishes with the Chechen guerrillas in the Caucasus, and wrote some very important pieces of reportage, which I think are very helpful for us in seeing his future philosophy of life in embryo.
These stories were published by Tolstoy as the Sevastopol Sketches, and in them we find the seeds of what would become War and Peace. Donna Orman.
Tolstoy's own war experience was crucial. If he had not served in Crimea, he could never have written War and Peace for all kinds of reasons. But just to give you one example, most of the war scenes in War and Peace have to do with artillery, and that's because Tolstoy was an artillery officer. So he's transferring his experience as an artillery officer to writing War and Peace. And of course, the same is true in the Sevastopol sketches, that he tells what he knows.
What is bad? What is good? What should one love? What hate? Why live? And what am I? What is life? What is death? What power rules over everything? He asked himself. And there was no answer to any of these questions except one, which was not logical and was not at all an answer to these questions. This answer was, you will die and everything will end. You will die and learn everything, or stop asking.
At the age of 50, and at the height of his literary fame, Tolstoy experienced a spiritual crisis. Komikyo.
Tolstoy, by that age, had achieved so much in life. Of the things that we would normally think to be good in life, Tolstoy had them all in abundance. He was of noble birth, he was wealthy, he had his wife and children, he was famous because of his creative output. And yet he has this crisis in which he sees his life as meaningless. He was desperate for a very profound meaningfulness to his life that he simply wasn't getting from wealth and fame and success and family life. So out of his crisis did come some very real changes. It may have been a long time in coming, but there were changes in his outlook from his crisis, and principal among them was his pacifism, his Christian pacifism.
He was searching for a way to live both happily and morally, and he was going through experiments. You could sort of see the great novels as reflecting his experiments. They're not him, but they are reflecting those experiments. So at the end of War and Peace, you have Pierre and Natasha in a wonderful intimacy and closeness. At the end of Anna Karenina, it's much, much bleaker, but Levin, the male character, he has actually reached a point where he feels like committing suicide, which Tolstoy also did at this point, and he comes to a kind of way of being able to be with his family and to live not as close. He's not as close to his wife as Pierre and Natasha are, but he comes to an accommodation. But that's important because that's the very time that Tolstoy is going through his crisis. So he writes Anna Karenina, and he ends that novel. There is a solution, or at least a temporary solution, so that the novel can end. But Tolstoy's life did not end. He continued with this problem. His wife was very religious in the conventional sense, and he tried to follow her by going to church and so on. That was not going to work. And he was becoming more and more upset about political and social conditions in his country. The serfs had been freed in the early 1860s, and this did not lead to a great flowering of Russia. In fact, it led to tremendous chaos and the impoverishment of the serfs and of their former owners. So he was very concerned about that. So there's a political side to this too.
Some of the sources of meaning in life that had satisfied his fictional characters, the love and the family life that made Pierre happy at the end of War and Peace, they were not making Tolstoy happy in his own life. He still felt he needed something far greater to make his life meaningful and to save him from despair.
I think you can see already at the end of the completion of War and Peace, this desire to following the dictates of his own conscience. And he had a bit of a crisis when he finished War and Peace. Eventually, he got into writing Anna Karenina, but actually his heart was no longer in it. And he stopped several times during the writing of Anna Karenina. So he began the novel in 1873 and only finished it in 1877. He actually just found it harder and harder to think about creative ideas in a literary way. And it was really only the character of Levin who made it possible for him to bring the novel to completion. And what we see at the end of Anna Karenina, in the epilogue to Anna Karenina, because the whole of his future spiritual odyssey in embryonic form. After the completion of Anna Karenina, Tolstoy sank into this deep spiritual crisis and emerged out of it initially as a devout Orthodox Christian. And then in that mercurial way, which led him earlier to go off to the Caucasus, he suddenly abandoned his faith in the Orthodox Church as an institution and started reading the Gospels in a new way. And out of that reading came this idiosyncratic form of Christianity. And at the centre of it was this idea about non-resistance to violence.
Rosamund Bartlett. Tolstoy based his pacifism on his understanding of the teachings of Christ, though he firmly rejected both the church and the state, making him something of an anarchist. Colm McHugh.
Tolstoy was a religious pacifist rather than an ethical or political pacifist. His concern was a spiritual meaning in his life, and it was because of that concern for a meaning in his existence that he adopts the rules that he finds in the Sermon on the Mount spelled out by Jesus. And his ethics and his politics and his pacifism are just implications of those rules for a meaningful life that he finds in the Sermon on the Mount. So his pacifism is a rejection of violence and, quite coherently, a rejection of the state that flows on from an adoption of non-violence as the route to a meaningfulness in his own personal life and existence.
He was a rebel in all things, really. He didn't like authority and he didn't respect the Tsarist government. But I think his opposition to Vissarion's government came more out of his religious stance, that he thought that the government was innately moral because there was violence at its heart.
For Tolstoy, you can't separate Christianity and anarchism. They are the same. For Tolstoy, he's a Christian, but not a Christian that lots of Christians would agree with. He doesn't believe in original sin. He believes that man is naturally good. And he believes that evil and sin come into the world through lust and love of power. And he believes that states constitute themselves as reflections of that lust and love of power. So anarchism for him, Christian anarchism, is people living in this state of good, which they would naturally live in if it were not for the formation of these states.
Late in life, Tolstoy set out his ideas about pacifism in a long tract, The Kingdom of God is Within You.
Besides, the justification of violence used against a neighbor for the sake of defending another man against worse violence is always incorrect. Because in using violence against an evil which is not yet accomplished, it is impossible to know which evil will be greater, whether the evil of my violence or that against which I wish to defend my neighbor. We execute a criminal, thus freeing society from him. And we are positively unable to tell whether the criminal would not have changed on the morrow and whether our execution is not a useless cruelty. We lock up a man whom we suppose to be a dangerous member of society, but beginning with tomorrow, this man may cease to be dangerous, and his incarceration is futile. I see that a man whom I know to be a robber is pursuing a girl, and I have a gun in my hand. I kill the robber and save the girl. The robber has certainly been killed or wounded, but it is unknown to me what would happen if that were not the case. What an enormous amount of evil must take place, as it actually does, as the result of arrogating to ourselves the right to prevent an evil that may occur. 99 hundredths of the evil of the world, from the Inquisition to dynamite bombs and the executions and sufferings of tens of thousands of so-called political criminals, are based on this reflection.
Tolstoy believes that we can act against evil, but we must do so non-violently. And much of Tolstoy's own life was resisting the evil that he saw, including from the government. So he did make his protests, he did write his pamphlets and his parables, and he did act against evil as he saw it, but he did so non-violently. So non-violence was to Tolstoy a way of being entirely autonomous, of not allowing anybody control over him and allowing him to maintain control of his own actions at all times.
The principles of non-violent direct action are familiar to us today in the stories of Mahatma Gandhi and of Martin Luther King. It was Tolstoy who inspired Gandhi in his great crusade against British rule in India, and Gandhi who in turn inspired King during America's civil rights struggle. But like Clausewitz, Tolstoy's pacifism also had an impact on the history of World War I. 4 years after his death, his ideas were to find expression in the actions of those who refused to fight or be conscripted, and who became known as conscientious objectors.
Tolstoy left to the 20th century a model of a person who stands firmly by their own conscience and who stands back from politics and society to preserve the autonomy of their own conscience. The 20th century was a century of violence. It was not at all the sort of society that Tolstoy wanted, the sort of society that he thought people, you know, were on the verge of accepting. So soon after Tolstoy's death in 1910, there came the slaughter of the First World War, and in Russia, the 1917 revolutions, and then the awful excesses of the Soviet state in the Soviet Union. So the after Tolstoy's death came violence on a scale that he simply couldn't have anticipated. But he did leave to that century this example of a person who lived by their own conscience and who was prepared to stand aside from society and politics in order to remain true to his conscience and what he believed to be right and wrong.
In the 1890s, there was universal conscription, both in Russia and elsewhere. And there, Tolstoy was immensely influential. And there were many men who refused to go to war. In Russia, they would be sent to Siberia, and Tolstoy complained, why don't they send me? I'm the one who is telling them not to go. I'm the one who should be going to Siberia. But of course, they wouldn't touch Tolstoy because it would be too much of a scandal. So during that period, he was enormously influential in encouraging the conscientious objection movement. And at the same time, he was also predicting a kind of apocalypse, which I think is World War I.
These ideas had a very great impact on young men who were conscripted. A lot of people decided that they would not take up arms. The most famous case is perhaps a young man called Stephen Hobhouse, who came from a very distinguished family, who was sent to prison for his beliefs. And he had picked up a copy of one of Tolstoy's religious works on Oxford Station while he was a student at the university, and it had completely revolutionized his ideas. So a lot of people did cite Tolstoy directly during World War I as a chief cause for them becoming conscientious objectors.
If he had lived to see the outbreak of war in 1914, how do you think he would understand that? And what advice would he give to those caught up in that terrible conflict?
It's impossible to say how he would have reacted, because one of the great things about Tolstoy is that he's not predictable. His writings are extremely powerful in their logic, but his reactions are very spontaneous and come from the heart. I think Tolstoy would have been a pacifist in World War I, for sure.
On Hindsight on RN, you've been listening to War and Peace, produced and presented by Gary Bryson, with technical production by Phil McKellar. The readings were by Alex Menglett and David Baldwin.